Good morning. Welcome to Mountain Money. This is Larry Warren, guest host this morning. Alex Butwinski joins me in the studio. Good morning.
Morning, Larry. How's it going?
Good. I think we have a decent week of weather ahead of us, at least until the end of the week. A surprise thunderstorm snuck up on us last night, but looks like it'll get into the mid-60s today and throughout the week, actually 76 by Wednesday. So a gorgeous sunny start to the week and should be great. And we've got an interesting show today. Very pleased to have as our first guest Jack Ewing of the New York Times joining us. And he has a new book that's going to be a blockbuster. It comes out tomorrow, so it's hot off the press. Faster, Higher, Farther, The Volkswagen Scandal. This has already been optioned for a movie, and reading the book, it plays out like a movie. It's kind of a Watergate on wheels.
Yeah, really, it really was actually gripping, and in the intro they talk about it being like a novel as opposed to a historical whatever, you know, listing of what happened with Volkswagen. Yeah. And it was like a mystery thriller.
Yeah, so very pleased to have Jack on the line with us.
And then we'll be talking to Pat Quigley of Club L'Esprit and their recent acquisition of the iconic Treasure Mountain Inn. Club L'Esprit has operated in our market since 2002, and over the last 15 years, Club L'Esprit's management services have expanded to 7 iconic destinations and evolved into the technology and financial management sectors. So we'll be talking to them, and that should be really interesting. And finally, our third guest will be Ryan Torsicolo, owner of Wasatch Arborist, to talk about trees. And we'll be back after this.
Gordo here, and I'm Larry with All Resort Group, a proud sponsor of KPCW.
We provide transportation to the airport, Park City, and Deer Valley, utilizing private black cars, SUVs, and shared ride van service.
Reservations at allresort.com or 649-3999.
We move people.
This is Matt Mitten, attorney with Jones Waldo, a Park City law firm. Longtime supporters of KPCW, our firm provides estate planning and other personal legal services to residents of Summit County and beyond. We are online at joneswaldo.com and 435-200-0085.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We have Jack Ewing on the line with us. Let me tell you a little bit about Jack. He's covered business and economics from Frankfurt, Germany for the New York Times for the last 7 years now, and he's worked in Germany as a journalist since 1994. Prior to the Times, he was a Business Week correspondent. And of course, Jack, that put you right in the middle of covering the Volkswagen story. First of all, welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, I would imagine this is the front end of a long line of book interviews you'll be doing. The book, as Alex said, really unfolds beautifully, and the first half is a fascinating history of Volkswagen and how it got together with Audi and Porsche and became this huge worldwide brand. But let's skip to, in the interests of time, to what makes it so interesting, which is the scandal. So tell us a little bit, pick up the story when a new guy takes over, but he's a Volkswagen insider and has new ambitions for the company. What did he try to accomplish with his what became the debacle?
Right. Yeah, well, first of all, I love that phrase, Watergate on wheels. I guess the story begins around the beginning of the 1990s when this guy named Ferdinand Piëch takes over the company, and he was a grandson of Ferdinand Porsche, who was the guy who designed the original Volkswagen Beetle. And Piëch, the grandson, was an automotive genius. He really improved the whole product lineup, but he was a dictator, fired people very easily and created a culture where failure basically wasn't an option. And around the beginning of the mid-2000s, they decided they wanted to become the biggest car company in the world. And to do that, they had to greatly increase their market share in the United States. And they decided that they would sell diesel as an environmentally friendly alternative to the Toyota Prius, and they were really targeting the sort of green, environmentally conscious buyers.
And can I interrupt and just say,
please,
that just seems counterintuitive. Diesels are known for spewing black smoke, and what could be cleaner than a battery-powered car?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, theoretically, that Volkswagen had, made a lot of progress in making diesels less smelly and quieter and sort of civilizing them, but it wasn't enough to meet the U.S. Standards on nitrogen oxides, which is really the pollutant that diesels produce that's the hardest to deal with and the most dangerous. And that's when they came up with the idea, well, all we have to really do is pass the test. So they came up with some actually pretty clever software that could recognize the test cycle when the regulators put the car on rollers, crank up the pollution equipment, and the rest of the time they turned down the pollution equipment to protect it because it couldn't handle continuous use and polluted more than a long-haul diesel truck.
Yeah, that was part of the way in which the story unfolded, like a mystery novel, and what they were trying to do to... I mean, at the end of the day, it was a huge cover-up. I mean, it started, I guess, in 06, and it ran through 2015, possibly.
It just seemed,
just incredible. But what caused that to happen? I mean, Larry referred to Pius coming in and the his goals, and followed up, I guess, by Winterkorn.
Right.
What was in their culture, or what was in their basic management structure that allowed that to happen?
I think it was on the one side, setting very ambitious goals, which is not necessarily a bad thing. That's a lot of corporations do that, but you need to have some boundaries, and you need to have to say, okay, these are our values. We're not going to, in our pursuit of these goals, we're not going to violate them. And that's what was missing at Volkswagen. They had had some previous scandals, not involving emissions, but supplying prostitutes to the labor union, some stuff that really did not make the company seem like very ethical. But there had never really been any reform. There was weak compliance. And so, if you create that kind of atmosphere and the engineers run into a problem, then you're asking for that type of cheating. And we've seen now what the cost of that is.
Yeah, and that cheating was not brand new with Volkswagen and the Jetta diesel TDI engine. You write that Audi had been involved in this, and even Cadillac had done some installing of cheat devices. So this was not exactly a totally new Volkswagen innovation.
No, I mean, the car makers have a long history of doing this kind of thing. When they started putting computers in cars and having computers around the engines, it was a big temptation to use that technology to get around some of the inconvenient emissions regulations. But around the end of the 90s, a bunch of truck makers were caught in the United States doing that kind of thing and had to pay a fine of over $1 billion. And that was a really clear signal to the industry, don't do this, it's going to be expensive.
Don't do it in the U.S. because they'd also been caught in Europe, and the rules are pretty lax, I guess, there.
Yeah. And Volkswagen didn't seem to get that memo. They didn't realize that things were much different in Europe, where they have almost the same rules, but there's very lax enforcement, and there's lots of loopholes. And as a European car maker, there's so many ways to get around the emissions that the rules almost don't mean anything. By the way, that's become a big issue now, and it's going to change. But at the time, they could get away with a lot in Europe, and Volkswagen didn't seem to really understand they couldn't behave the same way in the United States.
And they didn't understand to the point that the meeting at which they said we're going to deploy the cheat devices, you described that meeting as lasting under an hour, and everybody, it's starting out as a kind of a semi-joke. Well, I guess since we can't get the engine clean, we could just cheat. And that meeting lasted less than an hour.
Yeah, well, it just shows how they had a PowerPoint presentation. I think all evil incorporation starts with PowerPoints. And Volkswagen prided itself on very quick, concise meetings and quick decisions, and this decision was made, and then, of course, it wound up having astronomical consequences for the company.
Yeah, I think your reference was a three-page PowerPoint, which was like, that is a bit thin, perhaps, on information. You know, you talked about ambitious goals. I mean, one of the things you learn early in B school is, you know, goals have to be achievable, and I think that corporate pressure. I spent some time in the corporate world as a consultant and saw that happen at all different levels of the company. You know, just being able to, or at a lower level, setting a goal and saying we have to meet this goal or we're going to be fired, let's say. But one of the other things that I think was really interesting was the fact that the fine and the penalties for Volkswagen far exceeded anything that ever happened before. Which I'm sure shocked them, since their goal was probably more, we'll get away with it. Why was that? What caused that?
Well, I think, first of all, if it had just been the cheating on the emissions, it would have been a big fine, but it might have been hundreds of millions, maybe over a billion. But then they compounded it, first of all, with this very big clean diesel advertising blitz in the United States. So you had a lot of these environmental conscious buyers buying the Volkswagen specifically for that reason. I still get emails all the time from that type of person, very angry at Volkswagen. So then you had a consumer fraud. And then when this study by West Virginia University came out in 2014, pretty clear alert to Volkswagen that the jig was up. They should have at that point said, you know, put their hands up and said, mea culpa, we're guilty. What do we need to do to fix this? That's usually what companies do. But instead, they did this big cover-up that lasted another year and a half. During that time, they were importing many more cars. The car stayed on the road that much longer. And when the regulators found out that Volkswagen had been fooling them, had been feeding them false data, delaying tactics, sham recall, and so on, the regulators were really mad. And so all those things together greatly escalated the total cost to Volkswagen. It was sort of a perfect trifecta of corporate wrongdoing. And I forgot to mention, then there was just obstruction of justice when the whole thing was about to blow up.
let's just keep piling it on, you know, you mentioned West Virginia University, and this is one of the things that reminded me of Watergate. It's like this big corporation is getting away with this. And it's just a handful of scrappy grad students at a not famous for really much of anything university, West Virginia University, who discover, just testing three cars, one BMW and two Volkswagens, they discover the cheat. And it reminds me of Woodward and Bernstein, two young, scrappy reporters at the, you know, lower levels of the Washington Post, uncovering this huge story. Just briefly talk about how these students from West Virginia University found out Volkswagen.
Well, they got a $70,000 grant, and the idea from a nonprofit organization called the International Council on Clean Transportation, and the idea was they just wanted to find out how the German car makers were managing to meet the U.S. nitrogen oxide standards, which were tougher than in Europe. So they hired this group that specializes in emissions. It's run by a guy named Dan Carter. A bunch of graduate students hooked up this kind of Rube Goldbergian apparatus on the back of the car that could measure the emissions as the car was on the road. And that's really what did in Volkswagen because, as you remember, the software was designed to recognize when the car was on the rollers. When it was out on the road, the software was just letting the pollution go out the tailpipe. So pretty soon, the students noticed that the emissions were just off the charts, and they couldn't quite figure it out. And then they published a paper, and they didn't accuse Volkswagen of any wrongdoing, but they published their results. And then the California Air Resources Board saw the paper and said, something's fishy here. And then they sort of picked up the case, and they were the ones, the California regulators who then collected the evidence that eventually forced Volkswagen to confess.
Yeah, you mentioned that the regulators were angry. I think they were more than angry. They really felt badly misled. The interesting thing, too, was, well, certainly the number of acronyms. I had to write a little chart to keep myself on track and who was who. And I just learned how to pronounce Pius as the name. That was another challenge. The interesting thing about, is it Peach? Peach?
No. It's like, whatever you like, really. But I think that the German way is kind of Peach.
Yeah. So anyway, but that opens up the whole idea of the Porsche family and the Piëch family and their incestuous ownership of the two of Volkswagen, Porsche, Audi, and the interesting family dynamic of they didn't really like each other. So how did that all end up contributing to this debacle?
Yeah, well, Piëch was the dominant member of the family because his knowledge of the auto industry was much more than anybody else. But it's true that this whole extended Porsche and Piëch clan, all descendants of Ferdinand Porsche, were famous for not getting along. Piëch had an affair with his cousin's wife. You know, that's not the type of thing that goes over big at family reunions. it was just a kind of a mess, although they always tried to present a united front to the public. And then, as I describe in the book, the Porsche family didn't actually own any piece of Volkswagen until this 2000s, around 2008. And afterwards, they started acquiring Volkswagen shares using the fact that Porsche, the sports car company, had become so valuable. And it's a very long, convoluted story, but the upshot was that the Porsche family wound up with a majority in Volkswagen. So they're the dominant shareholder now, and I think possibly vulnerable to some of the lawsuits that are taking place because they could be blamed for, you know, not being good owners, for not overseeing management well enough.
And I presume they shoulder the burden of this whole scandal. But they, you write, they apparently still haven't learned because their punishments of employees who did this were very slim. I had a note here: 9 people in total were suspended. And most of those were with pay, and that Winterkorn hung on for a few weeks after, months after the scandal broke, before he was forced out, and he was replaced by yet another person from the old guard.
Yeah, and the Porsche family has been very reluctant to really bring in a new team, and you know, we don't know the new CEO, Matthias Müller. You know, there's no ironclad evidence tying him to the wrongdoing. He is under investigation by the German authorities for possibly not fulfilling his duty to tell shareholders what was going on. But the problem for Volkswagen is that as long as the old guard is there, the scandal still sticks to the company. And every time, you know, the German police search the offices or something like that, it generates negative headlines for the company and really punishes the vast majority of people who had nothing to do with the scandal and are just hardworking people trying to make cars and make a living. And so I think that's the tragedy, and that's why the scandal is still going on, and we'll have to see how that plays out. It's hard to believe that it can continue like this indefinitely.
Yeah, one of the sidebar ironies of the book is that the Porsche family earned enough money selling SUVs that were co-developed with Volkswagen, and they became insanely profitable. I mean, the numbers
right.
that you talk about were off the charts. So what's this mean down the road for Volkswagen? You know, you also talked about Wells Fargo, which means they didn't learn anything, and you talked about General Motors. So what's going to happen? I mean, I would think there's going to be some significant financial impact going forward.
Yeah, well, they have the settlements in the U.S. are the fines and legal settlements and so on are $22 billion or more. And then there's still liabilities in Europe. The legal system in Europe is not as friendly to plaintiffs and owners as in the United States, but the shareholders are suing. That could be another $10 billion. And meanwhile, their reputation has been hurt, so sales worldwide are kind of flat. They're still trying to get back to where they were in the United States. I think the biggest problem is that it's a distraction for management, and also the money that they are spending to deal with the after effects is money that they really need to be spending on new technologies. You know, there's this big shift coming in the auto market to battery-powered cars, autonomous vehicles. That requires a lot of investment. There's new competitors like Tesla that are very well financed, and Volkswagen, all the car makers need to be investing that in that big time, and so this money could handicap Volkswagen. I think that's something we won't know for sure for a few years, but I think it's a problem down the road.
Yeah, and just I think the last line in the book is they're coming out with two new cars, both of which will be gasoline-powered. Yeah. And is the Atlas still on schedule to be released this month?
Yeah, I believe so. And, you know, that could help. That's probably a good car for the U.S. market. It's a good-sized SUV. There's not going to be a diesel version, at least not right away. And it's from what I understand, it's pretty aggressively priced. So who knows? That may help them win back some market share. I think the type of people who buy a big SUV may be less concerned about the environment than Jetta buyers. We'll see. That could help them. And they're investing a lot in electric cars, and I think that's probably long-term their best chance to survive and thrive is to come out to become, you know, leaders in electric cars, mass-market electric cars that regular people can afford.
Interesting that Volkswagen only got interested in electric cars after they got busted, and suddenly they're embracing them. Just wanted to read a few other facts that I gleaned from the book that really give an indication of the scope of this. VW sold 11 million cars in the U.S. with the defeat cheat devices between 09 and 15. And in the first month after the scandal broke, VW lost 45% of its market value. So there's, I guess one wrap-up question is just, how could all this take place and no one go to jail? It's the same question you ask in most of these corporate scandals. They just write big checks and everybody seems to be off the hook.
Yeah, well, there is one guy in jail, lower-ranking executive who was involved in the alleged cover-up, who made the mistake. He's German. He made the mistake of coming to the U.S. for Christmas, didn't know that there was a warrant out for him, and so he's in pretrial detention in Detroit. His name's Oliver Schmidt. Other than that, the people that have been indicted are all in Germany. They can't be. Germany doesn't extradite its own citizens, so they're beyond the reach of U.S. justice. And it's very, this case, like other cases, shows how hard it is really to pursue the case to the top, because the way corporate decision-making works, a lot of it's verbal. You don't have, the CEOs don't send emails. They have people who do that for them. So it's hard to establish a paper trail going all the way to the top. The paper trail goes right to the doorstep. What we've seen so far doesn't go past it. So we'll see what happens. I think the Justice Department is hoping that some of the people who've been indicted will voluntarily testify and perhaps provide evidence against others. We'll have to see.
You know, Alex and I have a ski buddy who was a proud owner of two Jetta TDI diesels. And so we heard the story unfold on the chairlift rides going up for another run. And all in all, he was very pleased with the settlement offer he got. However, he took the Volkswagen money and went out and bought a Subaru. And
yeah.
And I would imagine among the green purchasers, especially those of the 11 million who bought the cheater cars, it's going to be hard for Volkswagen to ever get them back.
Yeah, no, I think they got to find new buyers, because there's some people that are just never going to buy a Volkswagen again, which is sort of too bad, because in other ways they're pretty good cars. But, you know, once you destroy your reputation, once you destroy your brand, it's very, very hard to get it back.
Yes, that's the tale that too many corporate executives learn the hard way. Well, I want to thank Jack Ewing for joining us this morning. He's the business and economics correspondent for the New York Times, writing from Germany. Been in Frankfurt and in Germany since 1994, covering the business scene there. Thanks so much for joining us. The book is Faster, Higher, Further, Farther, The Volkswagen Scandal, and it comes out tomorrow from Norton. Thanks, Jack.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Indeed. Well, now we're going to move on to some other topics. We're going to talk with Charlie Hare next with, or no, we're going to talk with Pat Quigley next from Treasure Mountain Inn. Headed to a high of 64 today, and 68 followed by 76 on Wednesday. And we will be back after this.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, presenting Viridian, 21 new residences along the 11th fairway of the Canyons Golf Course, with year-round amenities and gondola access. Summers on the fairway, winters on the slopes. More information at ViridianParkCity.com.
And we are back talking to Pat Quigley of Club L'Esprit, who is going to talk to us about their acquisition of, as I called it earlier, Larry, the iconic Treasure Mountain Inn. It's got a history all its own. So welcome, Pat.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
You know, a couple of weeks ago on Mountain Money, we had the Thea Leonard and Andy Bierman on talking about their side of the transition, which was to sell to you. Talk a little bit first about Club L'Esprit and what you do in the marketplace. Everybody's familiar with the physical hotel in Prospector Square, but that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, Club L'Esprit was started in 2003. I was the manager of East West Resorts property management entity here in town at that time, and I met the owner of Club L'Esprit, Scott Rogers. He and I got together and decided to start our own company. We purchased the East West division out of Park City, moved it into Club L'Esprit as our headquarters, and there's four guest rooms in the building. And over time, we've put in a restaurant and a day spa. We queried our customers to see what they wanted to do when they were here in town, and that's what led to the opening of the restaurant and the spa. In addition to that, we headquarter there and use that facility to check in our guests at our other nightly rentals around town. We have about 150 private homes and condominiums that we manage on a vacation rental basis, and people pick up their keys there, and we hope they eat dinner while they're picking up their keys, and we like to get them into the spa when they're here on vacation. So it serves as a check-in facility for all of our other managed properties.
And maybe I read this incorrectly, but aren't you going to move your check-in facilities up to TMI, or did I miss that part?
Actually, I haven't told anybody that story. So you're a mind reader.
We'll be moving. If they're listening, they're going to know.
We'll be moving some of our check-ins up to TMI. We've purposely not had two check-in facilities in town for a number of reasons. We've always tried to get people into our restaurant, and we wanted them to smell the steaks when they checked in, and that's worked well for us. And at this point, we were ready to expand a bit and pick up another front desk. So we will be moving some of our check-ins to the TMI front desk facility.
Okay, what's the opportunity with Treasure Mountain Inn. And what exactly did you buy from Andy and Thea?
We bought their management company. Andy and Thea own 15 condos within the hotel.
And they still do.
And they still do. And they manage another 30 in addition to that. So we purchased their management company. We leased space, office space, and the front desk space from the HOA. And then we've purchased three of Andy's units, Andy and Thea's condos.
Okay, and what does that allow you to offer? Now you have a hotel product.
Well, we don't have a lot of studio and one-bedroom studio and one-bedroom rentals, and so it's enabling us to diversify our managed inventory, and we see a big demand for that size of product in the market. There's a lot of 3, 4, 5-bedroom homes and condos, and there's also a demand for studios and one bedrooms. So we don't have that kind of product, and it enables us to expand our portfolio and actually have a location and a presence on Main Street, which we see a lot of value in.
You know, the hotel group here in Park City talks about heads on pillows or bums in beds or whatever. Not literal bums.
We don't allow bums. No, I think they do talk about
that. We don't allow bums in Park City.
I think the phrase is heads in beds.
Heads in bed. But how many does that give you now, the ability to offer?
It'll give us over 200 properties. And as far as beds, I don't know. It may be 800 or 900 because we've got some quite large homes that we manage that sleep a lot of people. And there is a demand for, you know, that size of product too.
Right.
Is that becoming what families want when they come to town? Is a bigger property, a house with a kitchen?
I'm really surprised at the large numbers of groups who travel together. We may see two or three families traveling all together, 15 to 20 people, and we see requests for that size of inventory every day. And I think when multiple families travel together, for just a little bit more money, they can get quite a bit better place to stay. There's a certain beginning point for a rental in Park City, and above that, if you have multiple people paying for the lodging, you can get quite a bit better nightly rental inventory if you are willing to pay just a little bit more.
So you started earlier in the century, and you've now expanded to other markets. So you proved up the concept here, and then you moved on to do it elsewhere. So where does Club L'Esprit operate?
Well, we manage and own product in Jackson Hole. We built the White Buffalo Club there in 2007, and we manage nightly rental inventory there. We have an office in Snowmass called Snowmass Vacations. We've got a big office in Whistler, BC at this point, Whistler Premier Accommodations, and we have a office in Mount Tremblant in Quebec, the highest rated ski resort in the East. So we have quite a big operation there.
So in going forward, I mean, one of the things we're all interested in here, I'm not in the business, but I understand that this past year for the lodging business was rather largely good. I'm trying to think of a nice way. Yeah, really
rather good.
What is your projection for going forward? Are you going to try to increase the summer business, or do you look like another snow season is going to impact your overall business plan?
Well, what we're seeing right now is a lot of advanced bookings, and everyone obviously enjoyed their time here last year, and we're seeing earlier and earlier bookings for specific time frames. During the summertime, the demand is mostly monthly rentals because people are moving here and they want to come to Park City and spend a month or 2 months or 3 months and then either buy something or decide if they can make the decision to move here. So the summer demand is really picking up. We're pacing a lot ahead, quite a bit ahead from last year at this time. And winter is already selling right now, the peak periods especially. So I would anticipate another great year. Obviously, it's somewhat dependent upon the snow, but the snowmaking here is great. So I assume that next year we'll see another substantial bump.
Well, I know Park City Mountain just announced last week what opening day will be. It seems like it hasn't even melted out from this season yet.
Well, some of these resorts aren't even closing this summer. You know, Squaw is still open, and I know Mammoth is still completely covered with snow. And, you know, I think the seasons are getting later and later.
It's kind of crazy. I was driving into work today looking at Bald Mountain, and it looks so skiable.
Yeah. Well, there's complete coverage still.
Yeah.
If you look up at the top of Deer Valley. So I would expect next season will be really quite strong.
Yeah, and that's so the success of this season just feeds on itself. And people were so happy that they're already saying, I got to get back
there.
They're
doing it again. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the building itself, will anything change there?
Well, we are taking over the Homeowners Association. Obviously, our goal is to represent the best interests of the homeowners. You know, we think, again, we believe that it's an iconic hotel. And I'm a history buff myself, and so I love reading about the history of Treasure Mountain Inn and when it was built and who owned it and what they did with it. And so our goal is to maximize revenue and increase occupancy and just work to continue to increase the value of the property. That's our only goal at this point.
Yeah, interestingly, that was the first million-dollar property built in Park City. And it was built way back when the ski resort started because there was a resort, but there was no place for people to stay.
I happen to have a copy of an original brochure that I brought it here with me. Andy's had this on display in the lobby, and it details the services and the pricing available the winter that Treasure Mountain Inn opened in December of 1964. So there's a couple funny things on here that I just wanted to read real quick.
Sure. That must be interesting. I bet the prices were a lot different than they are.
The prices were substantially different. But for $3 a day, you could take the Spiro Tunnel elevator to the top with your skis and climb out and ski down. I think that has value.
The skier subway.
Yeah, and this brochure also lists the other accommodations that were here in town, and there was a place called the Snowshoe. And maybe Bill Malone is the only person in town that remembers the Snowshoe. but it says that 14 guest rooms bring a sleeping bag. So accommodations.
They advertise that?
Yeah,
that's one of the selling points?
Yeah, so accommodations have changed somewhat, although I'm sure there's still inventory that requests a sleeping bag.
Yeah, but, and I think that other property was in the what's now the parking lot below the Silver King Hotel. And it was so bad they knocked it down. One didn't last long. Another interesting thing is the condominium. This was Treasure Mountain Inn was the first condominium.
I've heard that, and I don't know a
or
lot.
Or second.
Yeah, I think that they waited in some number of years before they even established the condominium document. So I think that was in the early 90s. So, yes, it was, I think, the first condominium complex in the West.
Yeah, and I know one of the guys who was whose dad was involved in writing the documents and said, nobody's going to buy this. You only get you get the paint on the wall and everything between, and you don't own – nobody's going to do that. And now everybody does that nationwide.
Well, let me read real quick what they're saying about the opening for Treasure Mountain Inn. They say it's a new million-dollar vacation lodge in the center of town, 55 units, studio, and one-bedroom and two-bedroom apartments with wall-to-wall carpeting.
Wow.
And all-electric kitchens.
Wow.
So, state-of-the-art.
Two things everybody runs from today. Well, thanks for joining us, Pat Quigley, with L'Esprit, and now owner of the management company for Treasure Mountain Inn and some of the units, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
Our pleasure, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Charlie Hare from Wasatch Arborists.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and company support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Hi, this is Seth Adams from River Horse on Main, and now Old Town's Grocery Cafe, River Horse Provisions, sponsor of KPCW. With all-day menus, daily prepared takeaway items, espresso bar, alcoholic beverages, and sit-down dining, we are located at the top of Main Street at 221, open every day, 649-0799 or riverhorseprovisions.com.
And we are back. We are going to talk now with Charlie Hare and Jessica Gray. Charlie, I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Yep, you're
and
good.
I incorrectly said we were going to be interviewing the owner of the company, Ryan Torsicolo. Charlie just pointed out that he's out working. So
he's up in a
welcome.
Tree.
He's in the trees.
He's actually climbing a tree right now.
Charlie, Jessica, welcome.
Thank you
very
much.
Thanks for having us.
So since I prepped for Ryan, it seems like he's had an interesting background, how he started out and how he ended up owning the company. So tell us about that. Tell us about your services and what your future is looking like.
Great.
Well, the whole interview. In one question.
Well, I'm still new at this, Larry. Sorry about that.
Well, Ryan, it's funny because in a business, you really don't want to focus on one of your employees as, you know, the cornerstone of your company. But Ryan really is. He has such an incredible background working all across the country, learning tree work on huge East Coast trees, winning, you know, tree climbing championships, locally, internationally, different events. So he's really a big part of what we do. So we like having him around.
It's always good when the owner is liked. he had quite a resume. What about yourselves? How did you get into the arborist business?
Well, when I moved out here, 9 years ago, I started working for the previous owner of Wasatch Arborist, which was Jamie Liddell, and he name of the company was Great Western Timber Company. And, you know, I started, just cutting firewood for him on the side. And, he invited me to try and come out and, you know, do some work on the crew. And started doing that, found out that I really enjoy, doing tree work, being outside, hanging out with good people and, working hard. So
I got involved in the company from the beginning. I came from the nonprofit world, and I've been Ryan's behind-the-scenes right hand since he bought the company a couple of years ago in 2015. And I don't pretend to know much about trees, but I certainly know how to help run a business. So that's kind of what I'm doing behind the scenes. So Ryan purchased the company from a friend that he had been working for several years. And like Charlie said, he purchased the company from Jamie Liddell. And it was named Great Western Timber Company at that time. And last year, we made the decision to change the name to Wasatch Arborist. We were getting lots of calls for log home building and timber products. And it was a really cool name, but it didn't quite fit with what we were doing. So we felt like Wasatch Arborist better represented what we were trying to do. And so we changed the name last year.
Okay, so it's all things tree care in Summit and Wasatch County. So what do owners of property need to know and do with their trees?
Yeah, definitely. I think the first thing is to go outside and see what you got going on your property. Call us up for a free estimate. We'll come out, assess what you got going on. The typical Park City home is, trees were planted 20, 30 years ago, very close to each other, a ton of trees. And, definitely... certain trees are starting to shade each other out. So coming through and maybe, thinning out a couple of trees here and there. We're all about preservation and, trying to, to keep your trees around as long as possible. So, there's different types of, reduction techniques that you can do. The Park City, tree that everybody loves is the spruce tree. So make sure that you give those a lot of water. We're definitely noticing that, they come out of the winter and they're starting to come back now, when we start to get this rain. But, definitely a little bit brown and, they'll come back.
Yeah, I would imagine spruce and aspen are the top deciduous and conifer trees in Park City.
They definitely are.
And like you said, this town took off and plantings began in, like Park Meadows, which was a sheep meadow and treeless.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
So all these trees are now like 40 years old.
Yep.
And this is one thing I've contemplated at my house is maybe I ought to get some younger growth in there or everything's going to die in a very short window.
Yeah, for sure. You know, another thing is, you know, a lot of the, you know, the houses that were built or are being built now, you know, a lot of, we see a lot of soil compaction, you know, with all of the backfill. So that definitely, you know, affects the, you know, the root systems of, you know, of the trees in this area. You know, also trees that are planted too close to the house, you know, can present, you know, long-term,
foundation damage.
Foundation damage. Yeah, definitely. You know, the, you know, destroying the fascia of your, you know, of your house and the siding, and yeah, definitely, you know, things to take and look at.
One thing that we're seeing in also Wasatch County is that there are huge old willow trees, and especially in the Midway area, they changed some of the irrigation systems in the past couple of years, and so willow trees need a ton of water, and some of those willow trees are having huge problems, dying. One tree we took out last year, it was a, I think it was a, I don't know, something like 50-year-old willow tree, huge, maybe even older. I'm not sure. However,
big,
it was big.
Huge, humongous, biggest
big
tree you've ever taken down.
Yeah,
it was huge. And so I think Ryan actually, when it was down, laid on the stump, and it was wider than he was.
Wow.
So, and these trees are dying because they don't have enough water. All these old irrigation channels have been shut down, and so the willow trees that were growing next to those channels are now waterless, and so they're having big problems down there.
Yeah.
And Larry mentioned that Park Meadows was a peach orchard. I live in Park Meadows, and it was actually a swamp. And it
no,
was
I think what I said was, was sheep meadow.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Sheep.
Yes, sheep peach. But and I have a gigantic willow in my backyard, which is thriving because of all the underground water.
Mm-hmm.
The negative I see, it is one of the, and this is probably not the right way, dirtiest trees ever. I mean,
oh, yeah.
It's just from last night, there were, you know, tons of branches down. What causes that? I mean, is there any way to keep them a little sturdier? Is it that they grow too fast? Is it that they're such a high water content?
Well, they're just, you know, they're very brittle tree.
Yeah, they're just a messy tree, I think.
Yeah, you know, we see that, you know, a ton. That, you know, with cottonwoods also,
right.
You know, they're just, you know, it's a very soft wood. So it's, you know, definitely very brittle and definitely likes to shed all of its dead branches, you know, anytime it's windy. And we've had a lot of wind lately.
But proactive pruning, which is exactly what we do, we really,
right.
We focus on a few services that we do really well. And pruning is one of them. And we have tons of equipment. Ryan is the best climber in the state. He's proven that the last couple of years. But we also have a bucket truck and all the equipment to get up in a tree, prune it, and kind of proactively take some of that stuff out so it's less of a mess, hopefully.
And there's a scientific or biologic method to pruning. It's not just whacking off every other limb.
If you drive around town, it could seem like maybe you can do it however. But in the field, there really is a specific way. And if you don't pick the right person, you know, if you don't pick an arborist who's studied this stuff and knows how to do it properly, you really can get poorly done pruning.
That means I shouldn't be doing it myself.
I do the stuff
I can reach.
You don't want to hurt yourself either.
Yeah.
No.
Don't get really high up on a ladder.
I don't do that. I have one of those long pole things, and I do what I can reach, and I only cut the ones that are, you know, quarter. The thing grows new branches as fast as it sheds branches. It's one of the, I don't know what to call the trees ever, but.
Prolific.
Yeah. It's, so, and it sucks up huge amounts of water.
Yeah, for sure.
And one of the other things that I've noticed is the spruce tree comment that you made, which I have a couple of them that are brown. And you would think after a wet winter they would be fine, but and I learned last year that they do. They also suck up huge amounts of water.
Tons of water, definitely.
Now, another service you offer is power line clearing, and I thought that was the responsibility of the power company.
Yes. So the power companies contract with tree companies to do the tree trimming off of the power lines. Most of the power around this area is Rocky Mountain Power. They have huge contracts with huge companies. We work with Heber Light and Power. They're a smaller company with a smaller contract, and so they went with us. We earned that contract this year, and so we have, since January, been clearing the power lines in Wasatch County. So that's not something We could do it residentially. So the power company takes care of what's on the street. The line from the street to your house is called the house drop. Mm-hmm. You're responsible for that. So we could come do that for people on a residential, in a residential setting. And we have all of our staff with the qualifications to do that because it is so dangerous. If you touch a tree branch that is touching the line, you can be electrocuted. It's far more dangerous.
Wood
than
is a electrical conductor. Mm-hmm. Wood is a conductor of electricity.
Absolutely. People, and you, once I got into this business, I learned how dangerous it is. And people are being injured and hurt every day across the country. And that's why it can be kind of pricey, because the overhead is so high with the insurance. But yeah, it's really dangerous. You could be standing on the ground and touch your tree branch, and if it's touching the lines, you could be electrocuted.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, tell us where you are on the web and
definitely.
By phone.
You can reach us at www.wasatcharborists.com, and phone number is 435-200-5544.
Very fine. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you very
so
much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Leave a card.
And we'll be back in just a minute.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. I was just fascinated by that VW story,
and still
am. It's just amazing that with a 3-page PowerPoint and a 45 or 50 minute meeting, they could step in it so badly.
Yeah, your Watergate analogy, Larry, was perfect, because that was just like, okay, if we just go a little further, it'll end. If we just go, and they shredded documents. I mean, it was just, they actually sent out a memo telling people to, I forget how they phrased it, but it wasn't, it was very benign, but it was clear what the message was.
Pretty interesting. Having said all that, my daughter just bought a Jetta Saturday.
Gasoline
Jetta. And that's the car VW hoped would make them the best-selling car company in the world. And they succeeded
for
a while.
Yep.
They hit that peak, and then the scandal hit. Well, I want to thank you for joining us this morning. And I also want to say that tomorrow morning on the local news hour, we will be announcing the new general manager of KPCW. As you know, I am retiring. Middle of next month, and we have recruited a stellar new general manager, and we'll be introducing that person tomorrow morning on the local news hour.
It's kind of bittersweet for us, Larry, although I'll get to ski with you some more, so that'll be good.
Well, yes, it means more ski days, that's for sure. So thanks for joining us. I want to thank our great sponsors for Mountain Money, Mountain West Bank, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Jones Waldo Holbrook and McDonough, All Resort Express, Park City Mountain, and Apex Residences and Viridian Properties, Columbus Pacific Properties.
And also thanks to our guest today, author Jack Ewing, Pat Quigley from Treasure Mountain Inn and L'Esprit, and Charlie Hare and Jessica Gray from Wasatch Arborist.
And watch your trees. Yes, I think they got away. I have one that's looking problematic in my backyard. Okay, sunny through the middle of the week, heading to a high of 64 today. It's gorgeous out there. Could be as high as 76 by Wednesday. And then by Wednesday night, it's going to get cloudier.